The J Talk Podcast.
Yosh, 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 yosh.
Hello and welcome to the J Talk / K Talk podcast. I'm Ben Maxwell, joined as always by Sam Robson. So, Sam, how was your first weekend on the K League beat for Football Radar?
It's been interesting. It's been a bit weird going from doing almost nothing to being inundated with a lot of work. I'm the full analyst for the K League, and I've been doing bits in the Czech Republic as well. So, I haven't actually got to watch a lot of football over the weekend, but it's been interesting. I watched the Incheon Pohang game yesterday, which I thought was a very good game. So, yeah, I've enjoyed getting to grips with all things K-League.
All right, terrific stuff. So we have a question coming up from one of our patrons about the early doors of the K-League season and what the results there might mean for the J-League once it's up and running. And yes, it will be up and running. J1 will be back on the 4th of July. And 3 hours later, I'll let you know that J2 and J3 will be returning a week earlier. And so to celebrate that good news, it's great to have Sean Carroll back on the podcast. Sean, welcome back. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you, mate. Good to be back.
Terrific stuff. We were talking in the green room. Yeah, it's only been just over 3 months since your last appearance, which was obviously after the first round of the J1 season, before we went on a rather lengthy hiatus. But yeah, 3 months, it seems like about 3 years. How have you been keeping?
I'm getting quite used to it. Actually, it's quite nice for no football, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, Sam and I have got to scrounge around for things to talk about. Luckily, our patrons have come to our rescue in the last month or so. But I imagine you've appreciated the peace and quiet.
Well, yeah, it has been quite nice in a way. I think it's dragging on a bit long now. But the Japanese football season, as several of us often complain, just seems to never end because of the way the schedule is usually done and various tournaments that crop up sort of tailed on to the end or at the start of seasons from time to time. So it has been quite nice. I've finally put some serious effort into the book that I've been promising I would write since I moved here over 10 years ago. Because I've had more time on my hands, I've been doing quite a lot of interviews and making some headway on that, but probably not as much as I should have done. But yeah, so it's been good in that respect. But yeah, similarly to yourselves, like I still have to write a fortnightly column for Football Channel. And yeah, you do start to kind of scratch around thinking, God, I'm running out of stuff to write about now. And, you know, you've scraped the barrel. You can only scrape it so much. So it is in that respect. And, you know, also just being able to go back out to the stadiums again and get back out to watching live football again. It's very good news that the J League's announced that hopefully, assuming there's no second wave or anything untoward in the next few weeks, hopefully we'll be back in, 4 weeks away, basically.
Yes, indeed. So, yeah, finally some good news. After the state of emergency was lifted, we said last week that, yeah, the baseball had already decided to return on the 19th of June, and we were waiting around until Friday's announcement from the J-League. You were following along with that, Sean. So, we kind of don't really know any specifics yet, do we, until the full schedule is released on the 15th, so 2 weeks from the day we are recording, the 1st of June. Basically, all we know at this stage are the restart dates for J1 and J2, and indeed a start date for J3. And we also know that the league is committed to fulfilling all of the league fixtures. So that means 33 more for J1 teams, 41 more for J2 teams, and a full season basically of 38 rounds in the J3 season. So yeah, apart from that, we don't really know too much at this stage, do we? But it's going to be really fascinating to see how they squeeze everything in.
Yeah, I think fascinating is one way of putting it. It's personally, I think it's ridiculous how they're going to force those games through and why they're going to do it. As you said at the announcement, Chairman Mitsuru Murai came on at the beginning and just gave everyone the dates and said, yeah, we've confirmed these dates. This is what's going to happen. And they put out a press release almost straight away saying that, yeah, they were going to be playing every game. But why they're going to be doing that is, it's not unclear, because we know it's obviously due to the money that comes in from various sponsors and broadcasters, you'd assume. But you know, you've lost essentially, what, when was it, end of February? So you've lost March, April, May. You've lost 4 months of the season in what is already, as I touched upon before, is already a fairly packed calendar over here. You know, how you're going to force through, you know, J1, you can probably just about do it. But then they're talking about they're going to rework the Levan Cup and still do that as well. If the national team windows still take place and Japan play any of their World Cup qualifiers or any friendlies, you've got to account for those breaks. Do you play through them or whatever? And even if you do that, it's tight. And then you look at J2, which the official J League account occasionally do when they remember that it exists. They've got 41 rounds of games to play in 6 months. So you're basically playing weekend, midweek, weekend from the 27th of June until everyone drops to the to the pitch in the on the last round. I don't know how they're going to do it. I don't know how squads are going to be, you know, even if you rotate, you know, J2 and J3 squads are not the biggest and certainly not in terms of quality. You've got a hell, you know, there's a reasonably big drop in quality for a lot of those teams as you drop down the leagues once you move away from your best 11 or say, you know, your best 13 or 15 players. And then you've got all these other factors that you need to account for, you know, how are clubs going to get their stadiums available? You know, a lot of them share the stadiums with their local prefecture and they're used for various other events. And there's just so many hurdles to overcome. I'm amazed that they're still going to try and do it, especially as they've said there's going to be no relegation. You know, why bother? Why not just say we can't do a whole season and play half, play three quarters, force through as many games as you can? It just seems like a kind of strange thing to do when you don't really need to do it.
Yeah, it does seem quite ridiculous to me. I've been trying to work the figures out, and I mean, I'm tired just looking at it. I mean, we've got the 33 games. This is just J1. You've got 24 weeks to go until that week before Christmas. I think they were planning on doing the Emperor's Cup semi-finals just after that. But as you say, if you take out three for the international windows you would normally get in September, October and November, then usually the League Cup final stands on its own, so that's another weekend gone. So that's 20 weekends you've got left. That means you're going to have 13 of those as midweek rounds. They're still on about the League Cup, which I think they were thinking of splitting into five groups of three and letting Matsumoto just go back into J2, but that's still a lot of fixtures. Then maybe the ACL comes back towards the end of the year. It doesn't seem particularly feasible at the moment, but it is possible. I mean, then you're playing, I mean, it could be about 20 weekends, 20 midweek rounds. It's just going to be an absolute nightmare for clubs. I don't know how the squads are going to deal with it, how the older players are going to play, especially when we're starting off in the middle of the summer. It's going to be warm. It's just going to be an absolute nightmare for players. And how J2 is going to run, I have no idea. I know we haven't necessarily specified an end date, so maybe they're thinking of extending into January, February, maybe. That would at least ease some of the burden on the teams, but then that affects next season. So with the current dates as you imagine they're going to be, I think it's going to be very difficult for all the players.
Well, yeah. So, Sean, at the announcement on Friday, were there any sort of questions from journalists about that, whether this season might bleed into 2021? Or I guess, any sort of a scheduling questions were pretty much shut down by pretty early doors by Mr. Murai?
Yeah, as I said, he pretty much came in and gave the dates and said that was that. I think there was one guy, I think, if I remember rightly, he did kind of ask a vague question about did they have any idea when the last round would be played, and Murai just kind of said, you know, he wasn't able to comment on any specifics about that yet. So I guess, as you say, it's vaguely open-ended that they might go, look, we'll run into the end of January and then the following season we'll start end of March or April or whatever. They might try and shift everything back a bit. But no, there weren't many questions about that. A lot of the questions were more to do with the testing facility they were talking about setting up to make sure that all staff and players and whatever were being tested to make sure that they weren't tested positive with the virus. And also they didn't want to put any burden on, you know, the hospitals and the medical facilities here. So they wanted to set up their own place. And a lot of the questions were kind of specifics about that. So I was sort of drifting in and out because that kind of stuff isn't my specialty in English, let alone Japanese. But yeah, there weren't a huge amount of questions because, as you said, they kind of tried to nip that in the bud early and just say, these are the dates and we'll come back to you on the 15th of June with with the schedules. So that was kind of it. Yeah, we weren't really able to find out any more about that.
Just on these PCR tests, it was like every player, I think, in the three leagues was going to be tested every 2 weeks. Is that what I read from? I can't remember if it was your article or Dan's article.
Yeah, I think Dan put it in his article. I think that's okay. What it said. It was that everybody, I'm not sure, I think it said players and officials, but I might have misremembered that. But I don't know if that means officials at clubs or if it means like referees and whatnot. But yeah. I'm fairly certain it was that, yeah, everybody will be checked every 2 weeks to ensure. And I'm not sure what happens if someone tests positive. It just said that they're going to do that because they want to ensure safety and blah, blah, blah. But if suddenly half a dozen or more players test positive, does that mean those players are just taken out of the team? Does that mean that team can't play? I saw that, I think it was it Germany? It was somewhere, one of the leagues that did start up. It was something like that, that if a player were to test positive, that team would have to sit out a round or two. And So I don't know if the J League have necessarily announced yet what the situation would be there. But, I mean, that's also something else that could become an issue. If you suddenly get a flare-up and two or three players from half a dozen teams test positive, do that team just have to cope without them? And, you know, or does the team have to skip around and then make it up later on in the year? Does their fixture get called off that week? Or, you know, how many fixtures, you know, you're playing two or three games a week. If someone tests positive on a Wednesday, but within the previous 10 days, they've played against three other teams, do you have to then test? You know, it's just such a minefield of so many far-reaching consequences. And Murai kind of touched upon the fact that they were trying to leave a couple of windows to make up any games, because obviously they have to allow for the rainy season and the typhoon season. It's, you know, the J League is usually, it's pretty hard to fit all these games in. And so with all these things, as you mentioned, with the testing, how it's actually going to work in practice and what happens if players or officials do test positive is still one of the things that is, I think, still remains pretty much up in the air.
Am I right in thinking there's another kind of meeting on the 9th or so to discuss maybe like extra substitutes in games and that sort of thing to help just ease like the match day for players and teams?
You might well be, but I haven't been keeping up on that because there've been so many executive committee meetings and they've had so many J League executive committee, and then they've had this one with the baseball league as well, where they've been doing the joint ones. And the way that things seem to run in Japan is that whatever's going to be discussed in these things gets leaked to the media 3 or 4 days before. So they report it, then it gets discussed, then they come out afterwards and confirm that, yes, we did talk about the stuff that was leaked to you before, but nothing will be decided yet. We're going to decide that at the executive committee meeting next week. So I trip up on the exact flow of it. But that, if they've said they're going to announce it on the 15th, that would sound right, because it tends to be they have some kind of meeting around about a week before where they hash stuff out. It then has to go through various levels of being okayed and check with experts and, you know, their, what do they call them? Related parties, interested parties, whatever, and then they tend to announce it officially. So yeah, you might be right about there being something on the 9th, bearing in mind they've said the 15th is when they're gonna give the update. But it does seem like, yeah, there's gonna be five substitutes in games, which I'm not really sure how that helps. It just, you know, we've all seen enough international friendlies where you're allowed to make five or six subs. It breaks up the flow of the game. It doesn't, you know, if you're one of the stronger teams, does it really help you? If you're playing against Sagan Tosu and they're 1-0 up and they make a substitute every 5 minutes in the last 25 minutes just to run down the clock and break up the flow, it's benefiting the, for want of a better word, the worst teams. You know, and it doesn't necessarily mean because you can make five subs that your players are going to be fresher. It's different, you know, just don't make them play as many games would be a better way to do it.
Definitely would help. I think on that substitute, I think I'm right in saying from the Bundesliga, you can make the five subs, but only the three intervals, so it stops teams from using it as just a time-wasting ploy. So you get the benefits of being able to change your players without really affecting the way the game is played.
Right, okay. Well, that is good then, I guess, in one sense. But yeah, I'm still not a huge fan of it. I think it's, maybe something that was dreamed up by an executive at one of the broadcasters who decided that, yeah, this was maybe a way of convincing clubs to commit to playing all the games that they'd said they would.
Yeah, well, so obviously there's so much to work out, and that's why obviously the league needed a couple of extra weeks after making the announcement of the return to play before the fixtures themselves will be released. Just a general question for the both of you on how you think the J-League has handled this from the start, because I had a bit of a, I don't know if come to Jesus moment is the right expression, last night, but just seeing a news report on one of the late night sports news sections and just seeing the number 56 on the screen. And I've obviously referenced that several times in the last few weeks. We had Richie on. We're talking about how, you know, how the J-League has done such a great job in the last, you know, decade or so of getting into smaller communities and turning them into footballing hotbeds. And yeah, 56 professional clubs is such a massive number when you compare it to just the 12 professional baseball teams in, they're all in major metropolises, of course, while the 56 J-League teams are all scattered, obviously, all throughout the country and in various sized markets with, you know, various sized fan bases, et cetera, et cetera. I guess it kind of hit home to me last night how much of a difficult task this must have been from the start. And I mean, you know, we probably get accused a little bit on here of being a little bit negative towards the J-League at times, and that's just because we love it so much, and we want to see it in inverted commas perfect, and we know it will never be perfect. There's always things we'd like to change about it, but Sean, so yeah, seeing Mr. Marai there, and you know, obviously he would love to be able to answer everybody's questions about what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, that when they know they've you know got access to all these stadiums that the clubs don't own, etc., etc. But is this just about as good as we could have done, do you think, once obviously the entire country shut down for you know, the best part of a month or 6 weeks? This schedule that we're following now, with, you know, a 2 week wait until the fixtures are confirmed and then another couple of weeks before we actually get football back on the pitch, do you think that's just about the best case scenario we could have hoped for?
Yes, I think if you step right out of it and look at it objectively, no, they should have just said, as is the case in many places around the world, not just when it comes to football, but if you restrict it just to discussions about football, everyone should just be saying it's not safe to come back yet. We're not going to come back until it's safe. But obviously, it's not that straightforward. You can do that with lower leagues in England, say, or, you know, non-professional leagues, because that, you know, it's not people's livelihoods. But the amount of money involved at these leagues, and as you've just touched upon there, you know, all these other aspects of clubs having, you know, facilities available to them, of players' contracts and all kinds of things come into it, sponsor contracts and whatever, it isn't as straightforward as just saying to the league, you need to just do this. It's simple. The decisions are quite simple if you step all the way back, but then once you get involved in all the different factors that come into play, it's not. And I think they have dealt with it pretty well. I don't particularly like the fact they kept coming out with new dates. We're aiming for April 18th, or we can't do that, we're aiming now for this. And
yeah.
You know, why not just say in the beginning, we don't know yet? I mean, and part of that as well is maybe part of the, you know, the beast of professional sports. You need to give the media something, you know, even if you know you're not going to hit that date. Give the media that date, you give yourself a week or so of them talking about that, covering that, coming up with ways you can do it, and then it, maybe it's all part of just keeping the cogs going around. So I haven't particularly liked that, but I think, you know, they've also had the issue of the Olympics. They weren't able to just come out straight away and go, we're not going to play, and we're probably not going to play for 6 months because it's not going to be safe, because then that would be picked up by media around the world, and then questions would be asked of the Olympics. So I'm sure there was stuff going on behind the scenes where government officials or Olympic officials were applying pressure, whether officially or unofficially. So they had all that to deal with as well. So I think on the whole, you can't really criticize them too much, because it's been, you know, as you've seen with the way governments have dealt with this around the world, there's been very few who have done a very good job with it. It's a pretty much in the modern world, if you talk about the last 100 years, this is an unprecedented situation. And with the amount of international travel and international exchange and whatever a movement around between countries that we have now that wasn't, you know, that is a certain does make it an unprecedented issue to deal with. It's been very difficult. And I think as well, Murai in particular has always seemed very, you know, he's come across very impressively. He deals with things very well. He's always seems to be on top of things when he's making public, you know, appearances or declarations. He seems to be very unflustered, very open, very honest, very willing to try and answer questions and to come up with a solution. So I think on the whole, you can't really criticise them too much. I think they've done a good job with it. Obviously, I've picked on a couple of issues there, and I'm sure other people have not liked certain other things. But I think it's hard to point to any professional league or any government or any institution anywhere around the world that has been able to deal with this situation perfectly. So I think on the whole, you have to give them praise for the way they've dealt with it.
Yeah, I think I generally agree. I don't think, at least from the outside looking in, that the direction from the government necessarily has been that helpful to the J-League. Obviously, it looked all was rosy while the Olympics were still happening, so they kind of had to work towards that. And then, obviously, that's changed when they went into the emergency lockdowns and whatnot. So I think you can maybe argue that they didn't act as quickly enough when they played that first round, but you're playing Yokohama v Kobe with fans not being able to chant. Is that really the right conditions for a game to be played? If it was that bad that chanting wasn't allowed, maybe the game shouldn't have taken place. But I get your point, actually, with the kind of constant updates and saying, oh, we're going to play at this date and this date. But at least with that, it seemed like everything was well thought through. They had plans in place, like there was that staggering of games they were planning on, and the testing at the gates, and it all seemed like there was some sort of logic behind it, even if it then didn't come to fruition. So at least with that, I don't think they handled it too badly. And as you say, they've had so many things to deal with. I mean, there'll be pressures from broadcasters, from players, teams or whatnot. There's so much pressure on them. So I think they've acted as well as could be expected. And I think Mr. Murai has done as good a job as anyone could be expected in his position.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, well said, guys. And as most regular listeners know, it's not like me to praise the J-League, but I kind of think we've just about come out of it as well as we possibly could. Although, I'm sure the players won't be saying that in late August, early September, once they've played about 10 games in about 6 weeks or something. But anyway, let's start to move on to some of these the questions that we got through from Johnny Nickel, one of our patrons and one of our regular senders in of questions. Johnny's come to the party once again, Sam. It meant that we didn't have to come up with a structured episode plan all by ourselves, because Johnny came through for us again. Got a couple of questions about a resumption when the J-League actually resumes, but let's start with Johnny's first question, because it's related to the K-League, and you've obviously just started following that in earnest this past weekend, Sam. So Dan Olowitz has obviously trademarked the Chaos Energy J-League, and we're all expecting things to be a little bit haywire when the league actually resumes. But Johnny makes the point that having followed the K-League recently, he's noticed that most teams already seem to be in the same or similar league placings to last year. Mind you, it's only been four games, of course. But in using the example of the K-League, do you think we're overestimating the effect that COVID-19 changes will have on the league?
I mean, it's a very difficult question, especially after four games. I mean, generally, as he says, they are in similar positions, but you've still got Seongnam, who've made a bolt up higher in the table. You've got Daegu, who are a bit lower, so. And it's, there's like, what is it, 4 points separating first and seventh, so I don't think you can necessarily say that it's settled into a similar pattern. But I think generally speaking, the J-League is a little more unpredictable than the K-League. If you're doing a K-Pred, if you put John Book at the top, you're going to be okay pretty much every season, and you don't get that with the J-League. And generally, you've got a set number of teams at the towards the top of the K-League, and but I mean, occasionally, like Seoul last season, the season before, they dropped down a little bit, but generally I think the K-League is more predictable. But I don't think necessarily the K-League is going to be as affected by the virus as, well, the new kind of protocols after the virus. Let's say games behind closed doors. I'm just looking at the attendance figures you've got. I think K-League was 8,000 average attendance last season, and the J-League is like 19,000. It's so much more. They have a benefit of being at home in a J-League game. Like, a lot of K-League games take place in massive stadiums with very few people there, so I don't necessarily think there's a massive amount of home advantage you get. I think, I did check it, actually. I think the K-League is down at about 38% of home games are home wins, which is a lot lower than a lot of leagues. I think the J-League was in the low 40s at that. So I think it's difficult to make conclusions with the K-League after four games, but I think they're so different. Like, J-League, whether it's going to be the virus, whether it's going to be the lack of relegation that means teams at the bottom this season can just go all out attack if they want to. They don't have to worry about being relegated. I think that will affect like the sort of results you get this season. And just in general, the J-League is weird. Like, you get Kashiwa, who I've predicted to finish in the top three after being in J2 last season. You get that all the time when, like, you've had Oita go from J1 to J3 and back again in 5 years. So I just think, in general, the J-League is quite random, and the coronavirus, I think, will affect them a little bit more. Whether it's massive, I don't know, but if you look at, say, Germany, when I think there's... I've just got the stats here, actually. There's been 35 games so far in the Bundesliga, and only 8 of them have been home wins. So that's a league where you have more of a home advantage, probably more so than the J-League, but... That shows the effect that these behind-closed-doors games will have. So maybe that's another way to look at it. So I definitely think there's going to be some impact, possibly a little bit more in the J-League than the K-League. But, I mean, it's too early to say. Both leagues that we've seen have only had four games. So we'll only really know at the end of the season, or maybe halfway through the season, what sort of impact it has. But, yeah, it's an interesting question.
Yes, indeed. All right, well, yeah, there's obviously a lot to ponder. Once the league restarts, and that's, you know, we're kind of here to put on our predictors' hats, although, as regular listeners know, J-Talk predictions tend to be pretty rubbish. But anyway, we'll battle on regardless. So, yeah, I mean, Sam's touched on a couple of points there, Sean. So another question from Johnny was the prospect, obviously, of games being played in front of no spectators. And Johnny asks, will certain teams be hindered by that? For example, he says, last year Sendai were great at home and their stadium had an awesome atmosphere, as it always does. They were, however, pretty poor away from home. And I've crunched those numbers, and Johnny is indeed right that Sendai were actually the fifth best team at home last season over the course of the J1 season, which is obviously a terrific accomplishment, but it's not historically panned out that way, because the 2 years previous to that, Sendai were actually in the bottom half of the league in terms of points garnered at home. So last year might have been a bit of an outlier, and indeed, Kawasaki were mid-table when it comes to points garnered at home. You listeners might remember a total of 9 home draws for Frontale last year in their 17 home games. So they were, of the teams that did the best at home, you won't be surprised to learn that the top three in order were the best three in their home games last season: Yokohama F. Marinos, FC Tokyo, and Kashima. But then there were outliers like Sendai, and obviously at times the Yurtek can seem like a bit of a fortress, and they made it count last season. But so, Sean, do you think there are any clubs that will suffer from a lack of atmosphere inside their grounds?
Pretty much no. I personally think Japan, when you first get here and you go to games, it's very impressive, and the fact that the fans are singing the whole time and the way it's organized and, you know, all those kind of things is impressive. But the longer you watch games, the more, to put it bluntly, it's boring often. Like, it's monotonous. The fans constantly droning on with the same songs, and I think often that it almost has the opposite effect to that the fans would like, and then it just becomes part of the background noise, and I don't think it really affects the players that much. There's obviously famous examples of leagues around the world where the fans are more in tune with what's happening on the pitch, and it's more, you know, it does maybe give the players that boost when they need it the most, and it does, you know, the fact that they're booing the opposition, or, you know, not just booing sometimes, but there's some stadiums that are really intimidating to go to in the world. there aren't really many of them in Japan. So, and as you've just touched upon there, the three teams with the best home records last year happened to be the three teams that finished in the top three. They're the better teams. I think in general in Japan, there isn't as much weighting into who's playing at home and who's playing away as there maybe are in other leagues. Having said that, there maybe are a couple of outliers. Like obviously, Johnny mentioned Sendai, and I think that's one example of it. It's a very good stadium. They tend to get good crowds there. Kashiwa Reysol as well. I think that is one place that if I was a player, I wouldn't particularly enjoy having to go and play them because you're right. You know, the fans are right on top of you. It's reasonably intimidating, or as intimidating as it can kind of get in the J League. So maybe, but I'm not really sure. I don't think it makes that much of a difference whether teams are playing home and away. And I think it's more to do with, you know, who is the better team. And especially what we touched upon before with the, if there's going to be a busy schedule, you're going to assume that the better teams and the teams with the bigger and better squads, the more depth in their squads, are probably going to do better.
Yeah, fair enough. So, I mean, Sam, another club that is always lauded for its great atmosphere at home is, of course, Urawa. But they really struggled last year. Of course, they had a bit of an annus horribilis in the league, of course, while they were making it all the way to the ACL final again. Only two teams earned fewer points at home than Reds in 2019 in J1, and they were the two automatically relegated teams, Matsumoto and Iwata. So, and as we know, of course, with Reds, sometimes the pressure and the expectation of the home support at Saitama Stadium can weigh heavily on the players' shoulders, or at least it appears that way to us, of course. So, do you largely agree with Sean's points there?
Yeah, I largely agree. But with Reds, I think, with a passionate support, it's great when you're playing well, but when you're playing poorly, they're going to get on your back and make it a lot more difficult for you, and you do feel that pressure when you're playing at home. But yeah, generally, I don't think the J League is a league that is defined by a home advantage necessarily. I think compared to, say, the German League or other leagues like the Premier League, maybe, when you've got a hostile, intimidating atmosphere, that's where it comes more into focus. I mean, the only thing I could think of, like, say, looking at Kawasaki's record from last season, they were quite poor at home, got a lot more points away from home. So maybe when the atmosphere is, it doesn't feel like you're at an away game if you're playing Kawasaki. Maybe teams are going to be a little bit more open, not defend as much. It's only a theory, but definitely Kawasaki struggled when teams knew they were coming to Todoroki, they have to sit deep and kind of nullify them. They struggled in that sense. So maybe without that kind of mental feeling that, oh, it's a tough away game, then maybe that'll open things up for teams like Kawasaki. But yeah, I think maybe the teams that are going to benefit more are the teams when you have to travel to them. That might be the only edge that teams get, especially if you're playing a lot of games in quick succession. So say if you've just been to Tosu and then you've got to go 4 days later, you've got to travel to Sendai, then maybe Sendai can benefit from the away team being quite tired from their travels. That's one thing. But just in terms of atmosphere, I think generally across the league, I don't think it's going to make too much of a difference.
Yeah, fair enough. So we've mentioned that Kawasaki were pretty ordinary at home last season, but yeah, they were far and away the best team on the road in 2019 in J1, earning five more points, a huge five more points more than the champions Yokohama did away from home. So they won't mind getting on their bike, I'd imagine, in 2020. And I should have checked with you, Sean. Mr. Murai didn't say anything at all about these rumoured three groups of six clubs split up roughly geographically, did he? That's still in the rumour stage at this stage?
Yes, that's still something that was leaked and it hasn't been confirmed yet. I think that was sort of covered when he said he wasn't able to speak about the specifics. Mm-hmm. There definitely wasn't anything mentioned about how that was going to be run. But I think the J League did say something. They announced something vague that said that in the initial stage, games will be played between teams in the same geographical region or something towards of that effect. So they haven't announced it officially as to, you know, these are the three groups of six or two groups of nine or, you know, six groups of three or whatever. But they have said that while they're coming up with the new fixture list, they will initially be pitting teams against other teams from their local regions, I assume just to cut down on the travel. But yeah, I don't think anything has officially been announced in terms of which teams will be grouped with who.
Okay, fair enough then. So we might wrap it up then, guys, with Johnny's final question. He wonders, and we might have touched on a couple of these points already throughout the episode, but Johnny wonders, are there any other COVID-19 related factors you think may influence the league? For example, and we've talked about this, it looks like there is no Asian Champions League return on the horizon, which potentially opens the door for the likes of Yokohama Marinos, of course, FC Tokyo and Kobe to play their strongest team in every league game. I'd argue they probably would be doing that anyway, and playing a somewhat second string team in the ACL, but anyway, that was that's by the by. Is there anything else? I mean, yeah, we've talked about obviously the teams with the maybe the deepest squads might be better off, not favoured, but might be better off, obviously, for having to play so many games in quick succession. I mean, there's a possibility that for a larger number of games, there might be no home advantage at all, because some games might have to be played at neutral venues if other if home stadiums are already reserved for other events, junior high school sports days, etc., etc. So, Sam, why don't I come to you first on this? Yeah, are there any other COVID-19 related factors you think may influence the league once it's up and running?
Well, Johnny there mentioned like Vissel Kobe. I'll take those as an example. Maybe they don't have ACL football, or it's pushed back a bit. But you're still going to play, as we said earlier, these so many midweek games. And their key player Iniesta, for example, is 36 years of age. How many games in a row is he going to be able to play? Like previously, you might be able to save him in an ACL game and then play him for the two league games, or save him for the ACL, whichever way they wanted to work it. But I don't know how players of that age, and there are quite a few in the J-League, are going to be able to play three games a week or constantly. So the older teams, I think, are going to struggle with this sort of fixture depth, and obviously teams with a lack of depth. You're looking at Sagan Tosu, who have quite a small squad anyway. They've just lost Kanazaki. They might lose a few more just to kind of balance the books. So they're going to have to play with a shoestring team so many games. That's going to affect them. The injuries are going to pile up. So I think that's going to be the biggest factor. And then we don't really know yet about this League Cup, but if they bring in this group stage as well, I mean, that kind of helps these three teams. I assume they would stay out of the League Cup just in case the Champions League returns. But, yeah, that's extra fixtures on. So, yeah, squad depth, I think, is going to be the biggest factor. And I think that's one of the main reasons they've got rid of relegation this year, because no team necessarily prepared for this. I know Yokohama actually have prepared quite well in the last couple of days. They brought Amano back from loan, and they've just brought in Ryuta Koike, so an extra depth at right back. So they're on the ball a bit. But I think, yeah, squad depth, I think, is going to be key with the amount of fixtures coming up.
All right, so thanks, Sam. Sean, is there anything else you can kind of pick out at this, fairly early stage? We're still a month, just over a month before J1 comes back, and we'll probably have time to think about this in more detail. But, yeah, is there anything that jumps out to you at the moment that may influence the league, may influence teams either for the worse or the better?
There is one thing that came to mind, and that is, and it might sound weird, but hear me out. I think what we might see is that the better teams in the league do even better, because I saw something, I forget where I saw it, but there was an article somewhere or some data somewhere that suggested that now that games in Europe are being played behind closed doors, the ball is in play a lot more than it is when there's fans there, because players are not playing up to the crowd as much. You know, if someone gets fouled and you've got 50,000 people suddenly roaring and calling the ref for a foul, suddenly half the team are surrounding the ref and yelling, and you know, it takes a minute before play resumes. You've got all this performance. Whereas with no fans there, it's, you know, I don't know if you saw any of the DAZN sort of pre-season games they were showing, sort of, I don't know when it would have been, probably March, end of March-ish, April-ish. And it was odd because, yeah, the game just seemed to go on. You know, the ball would go out for a corner, both players would put their hands up and appeal for it, referee would call it, and they'd carry on. Whereas when the stadium's full, or you've got, you know, three quarters of a full stadium and everyone's reacting, it seems there's more aggro, there's more complaining, there's more of this nonsense going on to play up to the crowd. So I wonder if the ball is going to be in play more, if players pretty much just accept decisions once they've been made because, you know, you haven't got to play to the gallery. Teams like Marinos, like Kawasaki, you would think statistically they're likely to do better because the ball's going to be in play more and they're better when the ball's in play. When they've got possession, they're going to make more chances, which means surely they're going to score more goals. So you might find that in that sense, the better teams are going to be helped by this because as well as having more depth in their squads, better players in the squads, if you're playing more football, the teams that maybe rely on sometimes, like you said, if you're going away to Kawasaki Frontale and your Sendai, your Sagan Tosu, your Shimizu, and you might think if we can get a point today, and all you're doing pretty much is trying to prevent them from getting the crowd on side, from picking up their rhythm. If you haven't got that way of playing the game, of stopping the flow, of running the clock down, then I would think possibly you'll be at a disadvantage.
Very interesting. Sam, that occurred to you. That's an interesting point to consider, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. I did see this. I think it came out last weekend. There was that study. So, yeah, really interesting point. I definitely agree with him. When you're a team and your last 15 minutes, you're 0-0 with Kawasaki, you're desperate to do anything. Your time waste, you'll do anything. And that sort of behaviour isn't quite as apparent when you've got no one to play up to. You haven't got a crowd that you're riling up or supporting you as it could be. So I think, yeah, it's definitely a very good point. And I think, yeah, well, I definitely see that playing out.
All right. So, Sean, I'll finish with a question of my own. What about teams that might benefit from what basically is an extended pre-season? We've been talking in pre-season, of course, about Peter Klimovsky coming in and trying to institute Ange Ball at Shimizu S-Pulse. He's basically had, until the state of emergency sent the players home from training, they had still been training after the league had been suspended, and they've obviously started up in the last week, 10 days or 2 weeks or so, however long that's been. So a fellow like Peter Klimovsky has had an extra, by the time the league kicks off, basically 3.5 to 4 months of extra prep time with his players to institute his theories and his methods, and hopefully to get them thinking the way he wants them to think on the pitch. And again, maybe the new fella at Kashima obviously didn't get off to the greatest of start, losing the ACL playoff to Melbourne Victory. But yeah, now that the Storm's died down over that, he's had an extra amount of time to work with his players as well. So do you think there's any clubs that might benefit from having that extra prep time?
I agree with both the examples you gave there, and I realised the moment I said about Shimizu S-Pulse running the clock down at Kawasaki Frontale that Scott McIntyre was going to be having kittens when he listened back to that. Obviously I was talking about Shimizu S-Pulse last year. This year they will be Barcelona light, or probably better than Barcelona as in their current guise, who knows. I think they're very good points, that teams that have got new managers who've come in are going to get that. As you said, they're going to have a bit more time to bed in, and the kind of the furore of it, especially for Kashima, you know, having got knocked out of the ACL and not started the league especially well, enough time's passed now that people will have forgotten that. He's had a bit more time to get his methods across. Obviously, Kashima and Kobe as well played in the Emperor's Cup final at the start of this year. So they didn't really have much of a pre-season. So just being able to, you know, it's not just about being on the training pitch, but being able to give the players a bit of time off. I know we saw in that thing the J League did with Olunga and Langerak and Jay Bothroyd, they were kind of joking around about it being hard to kind of motivate themselves to do training and watching Netflix. But, you know, that's the kind of thing that players often don't get. And there's a danger that they're not going to be up to speed once they're back. Not just those three, but, you know, all players. But also, I think being able to just have a bit of time off as professional footballers, you know, you probably wouldn't have thought that many of them have ever had this long away from playing games. You know, they've been playing since they were 5, 6, 7 years old. And you know, the likes of Bothroyd, whatever, he's, you know, pushing 40 now. That's a hell of a long time. So to suddenly have had 3 months where you can kind of recharge your batteries. So I think, yeah, those examples are good ones to give of teams that can kind of just get to grips with the new manager, ride out the tough spells that, like you said, for Kashima, they had a bit of a baptism of fire. But it's so hard to know because everyone's pretty much had the same time off. I know there's been talk about some prefectures have been able to train and not train, and some teams have been doing, from what I hear, some clubs have had players going in to train sort of unofficially. It's not been announced. They're not training together, but players have been able to go in on their own, and, you know. So I don't know how much of a difference it's really going to make in the long run. It might be more down in sort of J3. I heard Stuart Smith mentioning on the sister pod something about that. You know, these smaller clubs that maybe have been able to train for 2, 3, 4 weeks longer than others, you might have a bit more of an impact. But I'm not sure in J1 if there'll be a huge amount. But yeah, certainly new managers and play clubs where there's maybe been a lot of turnover, I think having this spell to kind of just take a bit of time away from the pitch and get everything settled down, I think will certainly have helped them.
All right. Well, on the flip side, Sam, I suppose there's the case of Sagan Tosu, who are pretty much going to run out of players if the season gets pushed back any longer. Yeah, they just seem to be leaking players. And obviously, a lot of that's financially driven. They want to get players off their books because their books are looking pretty damn ordinary at the moment. But, I guess the players that are left there probably just want to get this season up and running so they at least know who the guy standing next to them is.
Yeah, they could just do with something to take their mind off what has been a pretty tough couple of months, obviously for everyone, but for Sagan Tosu especially. I think even going into the summer, once this transfer window opens, I think they'll lose a few more players. So you're going to have to be, it's going to be a fairly youthful squad, which might help, I suppose, with the extra fixtures to have a more youthful team. But yeah, I think they just want some sort of distraction just to get out on the pitch, I think. And I think the J League, we were sort of praising the J League a lot earlier, and another thing is the kind of financial assistance they're giving to clubs like Sagan Tosu and others just to keep them afloat, which, I mean, as we were talking with Dan a couple of weeks ago, there was the fear that maybe Tosu might drop out of the J League entirely, so at least they've got a team to go with. They've got no pressure on them this season without the relegation, so absolutely, Tosu just need to get back on the pitch and start playing. I think the same can be said for Sapporo. I think they're one of the teams that have been off for the longest. They've had a few financial troubles. They've just lost their goalkeeper. Gusun Young's gone to Daegu, so that's going to be something that in an ordinary season would really be a concern for them, because maybe that drops them into, because they could be in one of those teams that's perilous and could be facing relegation, but this season they can kind of go without that fear. They've got that Thai player Calvin, I think, who can come in. Maybe they can bed him in, and yeah, maybe then he can hit the ground running for Sapporo. So yeah, I think a lot of teams will benefit from this kind of extra time off, and I think Kashima, as you said earlier, I think is probably the best example given how much football they've played the last 4 years, how much pressure was on the new manager. Actually, I think if we carried on for another 5 or 6 games, there's a very good chance he could have been sacked the way things were going, so it's definitely going to help him and Kashima, and I think a lot of the teams will have benefited from a little bit of time off.
All right, guys. Well, yeah, we will leave it there. Thanks again to Johnny for your terrific talking points and questions. Again, doing the heavy lifting for Sam and myself. And yeah, Sean's been terrific to have you back on the podcast again. Good to hear you've been keeping well during the break. And yeah, certainly things are about to get very, very hectic indeed. So yeah, enjoy the last month or so of it while you can.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Cheers, mate. It's been good to get a bit of a run out. Still not completely match fit, but yeah, hopefully I'll be up to full speed again in a few weeks.
Brilliant stuff. And Sam, yeah, again, terrific to catch up with you again. And yeah, look forward to doing so again next week.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to say thanks to Johnny for his questions. Thanks to all the patrons for the support. And if anyone hasn't listened to last week's episode with Ami Otaki, I encourage you to do so. It was a belter.
Yes, it was indeed. I mean, we're a fantastic guest. And heartily endorse Sam's comments there. All right, well, that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. On behalf of Sam Robson, we'd like to thank Sean Carroll and, of course, see you for listening wherever you are. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk podcast. Yosh, 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 yosh.